Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Global Health Forum on Blog Talk Radio. This show is a public service of people to people, a not-for-profit 501c3 registered Ethiopian diaspora healthcare organization. I'm your host, Dr. Antana Hapte, Chairman of People to People's Board of Directors. Our topic this evening is doctor-patient communication. There's increasing consensus that this is central to a therapeutic doctor-patient relationship and delivery of high-quality healthcare. A communication breakdown or non-existing communication is cited as one of the main reasons for patient dissatisfaction, complaints, and even lawsuits. There seems to be a big disconnect between the perceptions of physicians and patients on effective communication. In one study, 75% of orthopedic surgeons surveyed believed that they communicated satisfactorily with their patients, while only 21% of their patients agreed with that assessment. Doctors also expressed discomfort in communicating difficult or bad news. How important is doctor-patient communication in the therapeutic relationship? What are the barriers to effective communication? How often are patients included in decision-making? What does a doctor's bedside manner say about his or her communication skills? To help us answer these questions and more, we're joined this evening by Dr. Neil Prose, Professor of Pediatrics and Dermatology at Duke University and an affiliate faculty member at the Duke Global Health Institute. Dr. Prose has given seminars and lectures on communication skills to residents and fellows in numerous specialties and to physicians and nurses in medical centers around the U.S. He is the author of numerous articles on this topic and has recently developed a national curriculum in doctor-patient communication for residents in neurosurgery in the United States. He's also the author of a recent article summarizing the success of this project and numerous other articles and textbook chapters. Dr. Prose has consulted on developing curricula in doctor-patient communications in medical schools and clinics in South Africa, Botswana, and Kenya, and is currently involved in developing a curriculum in doctor-patient communication at the University of Gondar in Ethiopia. Delighted to have you on the show, Dr. Prose.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Sure. Can we start with you briefly describing your clinical role at Duke and how you developed an interest in the field of doctor-patient communication?
Definitely. I've been a pediatric dermatologist for approximately 30 years. And about 10 years ago, I began teaching a course for medical students and how we communicate with patients and their families. And in the course of that teaching, I discovered there was an entire world, an academic world, related or devoted to the specifics of how we communicate with patients and how we connect with patients and their families. And I became more and more fascinated with the process of teaching this and how residents and medical students can improve their communication just by learning some very, very specific skills that I hope we'll have time to discuss during the course of the evening.
Sure, absolutely. So is this skill widely taught in medical school in the U.S. and other developed countries?
Yes, it is. It's become a requirement in every U.S. medical school. There's a course in communication skills, and most of the medical schools in the United States and also in Europe utilize standardized patients who are actors and actresses who are trained to take the role of the patient, and the doctor or medical student has the opportunity to practice their communication skills or interviewing skills by interacting with the standardized patient and then receiving feedback both from their fellow students, from the professor, and from the standardized patient himself.
Okay. So let's start by discussing a little bit about the barriers to a good doctor-patient communication. What are the challenges in your experience?
Mm-hmm. That's such a good question, and I think I'm constantly asking myself what are really the fundamental barriers between doctors and patients. And also, as I've begun working in Ethiopia and other parts of Africa, asking myself, are these the same barriers in Africa that we face in the United States? And I'm convinced more and more that the barriers that we face are almost transcend culture. They're really international. And they start with the fact that doctors and patients essentially come from what I would describe as different worlds, which is to say that doctors come from the world of science and information, and patients from the world of their own life experience. And the life world of the patient consists of their financial concerns, their fears and worries about their own illness, the emotional side of reacting to a minor or especially to a serious illness. And I think that it's very hard for doctors and patients to meet because of this difference in worlds. The doctors tend to respond to the patient's emotions by providing facts and more information. We tend to be explainaholics. We tend to try to talk people out of the way they're feeling. And often this is fruitless because the patients want something else besides just more information. And so when I teach my seminars, I encourage doctors to imagine really what it would take to be, just if you imagine starting out on an opposite side of the table from the patient with the problem in the middle, what it would take in terms of words and body language to put yourself on the same side of the table with the patient and their family looking at the problem together.
Okay. Now what I find fascinating is how even the perception of good communication is so different among, you know, the healthcare providers and the patients themselves. And how do you think, from their perspective, patients define good communication, and what are the things they are looking for when they are communicating with their physician?
Mm-hmm. I think that's been studied pretty widely, in at least in the United States and Europe. And it seems to me more and more that patients want to know the doctor is on their side and cares about their welfare. They want information, but they want more than information. I think the one thing they really want enormously is simply to know that they've been heard, to really be certain the doctor has heard their story and understands their story. I think patients, I've seen this over and over again, come to the doctor, perhaps based on past negative experiences, with the enormous worry that the doctor won't hear their story, that he won't understand their beliefs about their own health. And I think that's the simple technique, for example, of saying back to the patient what you've heard, of reflecting back to the patient something as simple as, so you're saying the pain is getting worse, the medication hasn't helped you, and now you're really worried that you have cancer. I think that kind of reflective listening, for example, does a lot to move the direction of the medical interview in the way that patients really want us to behave.
Mm-hmm. That kind of validates their feelings and what they're trying to communicate. And I totally agree with your assessment that the barrier seems to transcend, you know, cultures and languages and all that, having practiced on both environments.
Mm-hmm.
But it is also interesting, though, to note that traditional medicine, which is still being widely practiced in countries like Ethiopia, has a different approach to it, where the focus is more communication than diagnostic tests. So have you looked into these aspects of different countries' approach to complementary medicine, not necessarily the modern conventional medicine?
Yes, I've looked a little bit, but not nearly as much as I would like to. I've done more looking into that in my work in South Africa, and I'm just very anxious to learn more about traditional medicine in Ethiopia during the course of my work there. Because I think that, for one thing, we can learn from the traditional healers what it is that patients want, because they keep going back to the healers. I think largely for the reason you're saying, which is because the healers seem to have an interest in the patient's story. And I suspect that in the United States it's not so very different, that a lot of people who seek alternative medicine are seeking both the benefits of things like acupuncture or chiropractic, but are probably also looking for providers who are willing to sit and listen and take time with them. So I agree that there's something that the healers are doing that would benefit physicians enormously if they could just observe it and try to discern what are the really positive elements of that interaction.
And would you say also that patients should be trained, patients by that I mean the lay public, should also learn how to communicate effectively in a doctor-patient relationship? Are there things they can do to prompt the doctor to be direct and forthcoming?
Yes, definitely, but that's really complicated by cultural issues. I think in America, a lot of patients, not all of them, are getting the message that it's okay to challenge their doctor, to be more assertive, to ask the difficult questions, and to seek out a doctor who really seems to care about their welfare. What I've noticed in Africa, not 100% of the time, but often, is that because of the cultural background, patients, especially younger patients, tend to be very deferential, are not making eye contact, and are tending to are very frightened to challenge the doctor who holds more power in that relationship. And so, one of my interests is what it would mean to educate patients to move beyond that cultural piece in the hope of becoming more of a participant in their own healthcare decision making.
So you kind of start to wonder whether the traditional doctor-patient relationship lends itself well to good communication, or do we really have to rethink the whole concept?
That's a wonderful question, because I think that the current relationship is really built on power and power differentials. And I think that to some extent we have to rethink a lot. And I think we have to base it on what the patients are telling us about what they want. But having said that, I think that in my experience, at least in training physicians in America, is that there are very specific skills that we can teach to doctors and to other healthcare providers that create an enormous increase in patient satisfaction. So without changing the fundamentals of the relationship, just by changing the words we use in given situations, we can affect an enormous change in how patients feel about their doctors.
Great. So can you elaborate a little more about the techniques you teach to your students, residents, fellows, and other?
Yeah, it's pretty simple, and we focus on some very, very specific techniques. And I try to explain to learners, this is not about changing your personality or becoming a different person. It's really about just perfecting very specific skills. And the skills include, and I'll just go through them kind of quickly, they include making eye contact in cultures where that's appropriate. They include sitting instead of standing when in the presence of the patient, because we know from several studies that when the doctor sits in the presence of the patient perceives they spent more time than they really did. And when the doctor stands, the patient has the opposite perception. And then we encourage physicians to ask an open question at the beginning of the interview, just tell me how you are or how are you feeling today, and then taking the time to listen without interrupting, because most doctors interrupt very early in the interview. And then we encourage to do what I mentioned previously, which is just to say back what you've heard. So what you're saying is, let me make sure if I have this right, and using that to kind of re-summarize what the patient has told you as a way of showing that you've been listening and paying attention. And then if it seems authentic, I encourage doctors to say something like, so what you're saying is this, you're having more chest pain than before, and I can understand why you're worried. That is to say, to name and validate the emotion the patient is feeling. I recommend finishing every single patient interaction with the simple sentence, what other questions do you have? Not do you have any questions, but specifically, what questions do you have? And this enables the patient to participate in the decision to end the interview. Everybody agrees that we're done. But it also, by saying, what questions do you have, it conveys the belief that the questions are normal. I'm sure you have questions. Please tell me what they are. I encourage the use of phrases like, let's decide together what to do next when there's a medical decision to be made. And when there's a disappointing outcome, the phrase, I wish things were different, I wish we had better treatments for your disease, instead of saying, I'm sorry. So that's just a sampling of the techniques we use, and then we kind of change that around based on the particular communication skills task, whether it was delivering bad news or things along those lines.
And then with your experience in other countries other than the U.S., you know, how does the language and cultural competency figure in the way you properly communicate? Because there's some cultures where family believe that they have to protect their loved ones from bad news.
That's the million-dollar question, and that's that's really the focus of all of my research and project creation, because for example, in deciding to do some work in Ethiopia around communication skills, I realized the necessity of approaching this as a complete beginner, that I have a sense, an overall sense of what the problem might be between doctors and patients, but at the beginning at least, complete ignorance about how that fits into the Ethiopian culture. And I didn't want to presume that I knew anything about how this might work in Ethiopia. And for example, the idea of shielding family members from the true diagnosis happens all over the world, and it was no longer acceptable in America. So having said that, I've been trying so hard to, on my trips to Ethiopia, just to understand what it is that patients want and what it is that really good doctors say to patients to win their confidence. And this way of approaching the problem began on a very particular moment when I was in Botswana, and I was interviewing a pediatrician at the university there, and he told me that the way that he knows if a mother has taken her child to a traditional healer is to ask about the soft spot, you know, just saying, well, how is the fontanelle, how is the soft spot? And by asking that question, the mother immediately knows that he's referring to the healer, because that's what the healer focuses on primarily. And so instead of challenging the mother about, you know, do you go to the healer, by asking that question, it enables her to gracefully discuss what the healer said and what traditional medications she's been using. And it occurred to me at that very moment that this kind of phrase, how is the soft spot, needs to be integrated into a medical school curriculum. This is not something that students would know unless somebody like this pediatrician taught them. And I thought there must be, in the same way that I went through all of the phrases in English that are very powerful, I've become convinced that in every language there's phrases in that native language, in this case in Amharic, that are really specifically valuable for communicating with patients. And it's our job to, through focus groups with patients and interviews with physicians and other healthcare providers, to turn that into a curriculum. And I'm convinced that it's possible. We've just begun that work. And I think doing so in Gondra will be a really marvelous and unique opportunity to transform medical education in Africa.
Okay. So let me take you back to the Gondra visit. How did it come about, and what was the objective? How did it all start?
Mm-hmm. Well, it started with a wonderful friend of mine, Dr. Kazahun, who's a dermatologist like myself, in Gondra, and we connected through the world of dermatology a number of years ago. And he visited us in America and spoke at my university, and I was explaining to him some of the work that I've been trying to do in communication skills. And he was absolutely fascinated by the possibility of bringing that to an Ethiopian medical school. And so he was kind enough to present that to Dr. Mengistu, the president of the university, and a number of faculty members, and then invited me to come several months ago to spend a few weeks. Professor Mengesha, excuse me, the president, and a number of other faculty members. And he was kind enough to, they were kind enough to invite me to spend 2 weeks in Gondar. Professor Mengesha was so gracious in introducing me to members of the departments of sociology, of anthropology, of linguistics, in addition to a number of physicians. And I spent those 2 weeks just observing what life is like on the wards and in the clinics, but also meeting with people to kind of start to discern what a course would look like, where it would fit into the medical school curriculum, and how would we begin to construct that.
Absolutely. You know, that's my alma mater, and I know all the wonderful people you mentioned. They are very, very good to work with, excellent to work with. People-to-people works with them all the time, and that's part of the Gondar alumni you know, association, we work with them too. So what would be the next step in the process there?
Before I move on, let me just say I totally agree with what you're saying. And my wife and I were so impressed by the university and by just there's a feeling on that campus of students who are so eager to learn. And you can just see it, and you can see it in the classrooms. And despite the fact that there's so many students and they're, you know, by American standards, they're dealing with a lot of adversity in terms of access to technology and classroom space and so forth and so on. I found it just extremely inspiring to see those students in their environment. And even from as an American, just the experience of watching how, for example, food is prepared in this enormous kitchen for 30,000 students, to me, was beyond, it really went beyond my imagination. And the only way I could describe it is it was really, I found it really inspirational. With respect to where we go from here, I'm hoping to return to Gondar in a few months. And our next step is going to be severalfold. The first is some of the members of sociology and anthropology are about to begin a baseline survey of patients using interviews and focus groups in the hopes of getting a more accurate sense of how patients feel about their experience. And we're going to have similar conversation with doctors about what they've been able to accomplish, what they think are important skills from their point of view. And then our hope in the not-too-distant future is start to create a specific curriculum. And we imagine the curriculum as being, first of all, not an import from America, but something that's really based in the culture, language, and especially or including the socioeconomic situation in Ethiopia. Because we know that doctors are working in busy clinics and crowded wards, and we want to prove, if we possibly can, that it's still possible to communicate with empathy in those difficult situations, in those difficult environments. And so one of our next steps, I believe, is going to be to create a series of teaching videos, brief videos that actually depict empathic, meaningful doctor-patient interaction in a brief visit in a very busy clinic, so as to create a realistic alternative to the kind of conversations that sometimes happen at this point in time.
Are there successful models for this concept, like you described, a different kind of environment, a different kind of setup? Because the part of the strategies you were mentioning earlier were, you know, how you want to have a quiet setting, you know, you mm-hmm. sit, you don't get interrupted, you kind of focus on the patient. So on environments and then you know, healthcare settings, which is different, are there models for this one?
That's such a good question. I'm not aware of any that specifically look at how one communicates in a very busy, in that kind of busy, hectic environment that I'm sure you know all too well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm convinced it's possible. I've seen, having spent some time on the wards, particularly in the obstetric ward, I saw glimpses of empathic opportunities that were being missed, that it wouldn't have been that hard for a medical student or a doctor to step aside for one moment and just communicate directly with the patient. So I know that it's possible, and I know we need to, when we portray these skills, we need to do it in an environment that reflects the reality of Ethiopia. But having said that, the residents and interns I spoke to particularly had a strong sense that this would be possible if it just were being taught. And so we're going to presume that that's the case and kind of take it from there.
Are you aware of a good model in an African medical school where the doctor-patient communication has been established as an essential credit earning course?
Mm-hmm. There are several in South Africa. I worked to help to develop the curriculum in Durban, and I know there are very good curricula in Cape Town and Johannesburg as well. And Botswana, I believe, has really started moving in that direction as well. My only concern about the South African course is that it's been difficult, I think, to create something that's authentically South African. And so there's been a tendency to import European, British models of communication skills and then merely try to translate them into, for example, isiZulu. And I think that what we're trying to do is a little bit different, which is to create something that really is built from the ground up, that really reflects an African culture. The only example I know of somebody who has done that is a physician in Pietermaritzburg in South Africa named Christopher Ellis. And he's written a book called Communicating with the African Patient that I use as a model for the kind of work we're trying to create, because he looks at particular phrases and concepts and dissects them and shows how they could be used to improve communication, but in Zulu.
And I guess one of the biggest challenges in this endeavor and in trying to develop tools and incorporate them into the curriculum, et cetera, is like, how do you measure outcome? How do you see whether that made a difference?
Yeah, this is the biggest problem that confronts all of us who work in this field of communication skills. Because to be honest, it's a very hard thing to measure. If you try to measure the patient interact, you can measure in several ways. One that's awfully simple, and we've done it many times, is simply to ask the learner, the student, at the end of the session, the teaching session, to identify a single thing that they would do differently in the future. And then we email them in a month and ask them if they've been able to achieve their goal. So not the most rigorous scientific method, but something that gives us some indication. The second an even better method would be to videotape students before and after the course interacting with standardized patients, and then use a standardized method of grading the interaction. And that's been done many times, and we may try to do that in Gonder. And the last and most difficult is actually to try to interview the patients of the students or the providers before and after the provider was trained, and to see if they notice a difference. But that's hard, because patients may not be looking for exactly the kind of skills we're mentioning, and it may be very hard to get the data that tells us that doctors have actually improved in their performance.
Yeah, so at the VA, we have what we call the PROMISE survey, which is done on the next of kin of a patient under hospice and palliative care who expired, and to see what their experience and their satisfaction is. It's kind of always a little challenging, because you're never sure what triggers, you know, good experience at the last. But training goes across the whole spectrum of the healthcare delivery, not just with the physicians and the nurses, but everybody who interacts with the patient and the family.
Yeah. And that's one of our concerns, actually, anywhere, including in Gonder, is that this is sort of, there's a global patient experience that kind of starts the minute you walk in the door. And there's problems with that that have to do with often with lack of resources. And so, and maybe that changing the doctor-patient part alone is not going to be adequate, or is not the main thing that needs to be changed. So we have to keep all of that in mind at the same time. And also to the effort to improve communication skills, it has to be coupled with an effort to improve the facilities that doctors work in, because the frustration level can be so high at times, and it's very hard for doctors, and I think especially nurses, to maintain a humanistic attitude when they're so pressured to work so very hard.
Right. And which brings up the question, I'm sure that comes up all the time. I have an email question from Toshoma, who says he's an internist practicing in Philadelphia, and says, I wholeheartedly agree that communication is a vital part of the doctor-patient relationship, but unfortunately it usually consumes a lot of time, and unlike procedures, it's not a billable exercise. Is there any movement in that direction?
Yeah, that's a huge issue, and I would guess that's more of an issue in America than in Ethiopia, and please correct me if I'm wrong.
You're quite right.
In America, there's sort of a disincentive to speaking to patients. I have a profession where all I do is talk. I have no procedures, and you know, it's reflected in my salary, for better or worse. And I love what I do, and it's not a complaint. But certainly, there are many doctors who would prefer to do procedures all day long, because it's much more lucrative. But it's not always what the patients want or need, and it's only in a conversation with the patient that you even find out if the procedure is necessary. And we all know how many, how excessive the number of procedures that are done in America and in other countries, and the number of C-sections, and all these things that could be listening to the patient's story. I often think of the patient who was sent home from the emergency department in Texas with Ebola. Mm-hmm. And nobody had even asked him, like, where are you from? Simple, the kind of simple thing you would ask anybody with a foreign accent. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me that in this case, they were probably so focused on the electronic health record, which was a whole other new issue, that nobody sat down and actually had a conversation with the patient. And in this case, it really cost him his life. That's my kind of rough assessment of what probably happened.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you're absolutely right about the billing not being, you know, the biggest concern in settings like Ethiopia, et cetera. But the volume, the sheer volume of the patients is the biggest concern, and the amount of time that, you know, the providers feel that they can spend per patient.
Yeah, I don't have an answer to that precisely, but I think we're going to try to fashion a curriculum that takes that into account and just suggests one or two small changes one can do in the same period of time to improve the quality of the visit. You're right, because the visits are very, by necessity, very short. But when patients are in the hospital, I think, for example, there is time to have conversation. And what I noticed in some of the wards in Gondar is that because rounds are conducted in English, the patients are especially in the dark sometimes about their real situation. And I thought how wonderful it would be if one of the doctors was assigned to stay behind for a minute after each patient is discussed, just to explain to the patient what happened. And that would be something that could be done without inconveniencing anybody, mm-hmm. and might make a huge difference in the quality of care.
Absolutely. We're almost halfway through our program, and I would like to remind our audience that you're listening to the Global Health Forum, a public service by people to people. I'm your host, Dr. Antana Haptain. My guest this evening is Dr. Neil Prost, professor of pediatrics and dermatology at Duke University and an expert in doctor-patient communication. Dr. Prost has been working in introducing empathic communication in morbidity-mortality conferences and promoting the skill for difficult conversations. His article on a national course for neurosurgery residents in physician-patient communication was recently published in the Journal of Surgical Education. Dr. Prost received the annual Leonard P. Tau Humanism in Medicine Award at Duke University Medical Center in 2008 and the Humanism Award of the American Academy of Dermatology in 2012. We welcome your active participation. You can ask your questions or share your comments by dialing 64742. Press 1 if you would like to speak. You can also email your questions and comments to info@peoplepeople.org. While communication in general is very difficult, and as you mentioned, it needs training and conscious practice of the art, communicating bad news seems to be even more difficult. So what is your take on that?
Well, once again, we have sort of a formula for doing that in America, which involves making sure you have a place that's quiet and you won't be interrupted. Trying to understand what the patient knows already about, or the family knows already about the situation, firing a warning shot, which is to say, I'm sorry, but we have the results of the biopsy and we have some bad news for you. And then giving the diagnosis directly and clearly, and then allowing the patient time to react before we go on and start explaining, as we love to do. So in America and Europe, I think we have developed a really nice method of doing that. And to the extent that medical students and residents are learning to do that well, there's been enormous progress. But having said that, I think that the lessons of doing this in other countries need to be learned. And I know that from speaking to some of my Ethiopian friends, I know there's some very important particularities about giving bad news to family members in Ethiopia. I know in South Africa that you have to be so careful about the, the euphemistic way you speak about death, not to be too direct or too insensitive. And so I don't pretend to know what that would look like in Ethiopia. Probably many of your listeners have a much stronger sense than I do. But we're hoping to kind of develop a curriculum based on what we're told by both patients and by doctors.
In hospice and palliative medicine, we use the spikes, six
yes.
steps protocol, and that has worked very effectively too. Have you seen any difference between, say, internists and surgeons as far as approaching communication goes? Because I know you just developed a curriculum for neurosurgical residents.
It's funny that you mentioned, I just finished teaching spikes to cardiothoracic surgeons last week. And it was very successful, I thought. I think that part of my work, my working with surgeons has helped me to overcome my own kind of hidden and not so hidden biases about surgeons, and I find them remarkably open to some of these methods, partly because they are dealing with such difficult conversations. Take the neurosurgeons, for example, and they know that they're really battling sometimes, the good ones, and many of them are good, and especially the younger ones, I think. And so I've been just delighted to the extent that which surgeons take to this. And also I think because I'm teaching them techniques, and surgeons love techniques, and so it fits very well. And then internists, I think, there's a lot of variation. There are some who are absolutely brilliant at this and very talented, and some who are not as good. And it depends terribly on their background, on how they've been trained, and to some extent just on their basic personality.
And then from your own experience, when it's a pediatric patient that is involved in a communication with the parents, or it's an adult patient and you're communicating directly to the patient, do you notice a difference in style or greater degree of difficulty?
Yeah, it just depends. And for me, I'm dealing with children all day long and their parents, and I find the challenge sometimes is to keep everyone in the conversation so that I'm able to speak directly to the child to some extent, but also communicate with the parents. And then if there are two parents in the room, they may have very different approaches themselves to each other, and then I'm trying to figure out how to speak to both of their concerns. So that can be a great deal more complicated at times. And then I think people are so kind of invested in the health of their children in almost a way that goes down to kind of brainstem function. It's such a primitive need on all of our parts that I think sometimes the emotional stakes are very, very high, and we have to be particularly aware of that. So I think that does present additional difficulties. But I also know that in Ethiopia, the way that parents and children interact is very different to America. And so I wouldn't presume to have a solution to that problem. I think I'm sure that it's going to be very, very different, because to say this in a nice way, I think often American parents are very are overly permissive and give their children too many choices and overwhelm their kids. And in Ethiopia, I've seen a much more kind of disciplined approach to child rearing, and it creates a different kind of challenge.
I think there are the basic commonalities where every patient or parents want to be listened to, want to be respected, want to feel that the provider is really in tune to that. But on top of that, there are layers of cultural differences for sure. I'm gonna go ahead and take a call from 540338. Please go ahead.
Hi, good evening. Thanks for the nice discussion. I am Dr. Varatharaja. I work with the geriatric population. What is your opinion about the family members who are demanding, sometimes they are recording our conversation, and they come with a Google printout, and how deep we can explain, and it takes sometimes hours of our time. It is actually an inpatient or long-term care setup. Well, how do we handle that, or do you have any experience in that, sir?
Yes, I have a bunch of ideas, but I also have to agree with your statement that it can take hours and it can be very frustrating and difficult for the providers. But having said that, I think sometimes there are several things that I think are really helpful. I think one of them is that kind of reflective listening when it comes to the child's concern about the parents. I find that if I were to say something like, so what you're saying is that you think your father is getting more confused and he's not able to remember things as well as he used to, and that must be really worrying to you, then the patient, in my experience, the family knows that you were listening, And sometimes that eliminates 20 minutes of conversation when they're trying to make sure you heard them. So I think that from my experience, that's been very, very helpful. The thing about the internet printouts is a huge issue. And I'm fascinated by that process. And I think that what I've discovered, because I have the same, I face the same problem. And what I've discovered is that even though it takes time, we absolutely have to take some time to try to understand what the family thinks they learned online. And I say that for several reasons. The first one is because we're constantly wanting families to be more involved in their own health care. And so when they do that, I don't think that we can keep the right to feel resentful about it. The second thing is that if the family leaves your office, in my opinion, worried that they know something you don't know, and that if you had paid attention, you would understand something different about their father or mother's health, I think that's never going to be a successful discussion. So even though it's time-consuming, and you don't have to look at every single page during the visit, I think you have to show that you're making an effort to understand what's going on. The third reason, which is totally in the realm of humility for me, is that now on three occasions, the family has made the diagnosis when I failed because they found the answer on the internet. It happens because there's so much information out there, and we don't have as much time as they might to dig through everything. And so I always allow for that possibility. And even if it's not making a new diagnosis, they may have learned something from another family about a method of dealing with a problem that's something we never would have occurred to us.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
So in your experience, is there any role for lack of a better word, for limit setting, whether it is in terms of time or
yes.
in terms of... So how do you approach that?
I think especially those of you taking... With children, it's not as complex because usually there's the number of problems that the family comes with is finite. But I know for the kind of internist or geriatrician who is just on the phone, the problems, it can seem like the list of problems is infinite and there's no way to get through them in the time that's been allotted to us. And so one thing that's been recommended in that situation is something as simple as, I wish we had time to go through your entire list. What we should do is, I need to understand from you what are the most important concerns that you want to talk about today, and then I need to tell you the things that I'm most worried about. And then if there's things we can't do today, we'll have to set up another time to do that. So it's a kind of agenda setting, and it's a way of setting limits that enables us to, you know, complete the visit in the time that we have. And perhaps, if necessary, schedule another visit in future to talk about other issues.
Let me take a call from area code 304-279. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Just thank you so much for the conversation. It's an interesting topic, and one that's I think pertinent to everybody at some point. My question is, how do you deal? With a doctor-patient relationship, sometimes it's just not going to work out.
Mm.
As a provider, do you have any way of saying, I'm just not going to be able to, help with this situation, and any, way of a handoff, perhaps, with somebody else who you think may be able to come in, some other team member, to come in and maybe just work something else out that you can't do?
Yeah, I think that's such a good question. I think we're all faced with that at times where it just seems futile that we can't, as hard as we try with a particular family, for a variety of different reasons, it's not the right fit. Either because it's just not exactly our area of expertise or interest, and we have a colleague who we know would do a better job. And partly at times, I think, because the personalities are so out of sync. I think that there are patients who push our buttons, so to speak, in a very particular way. And even though if we're aware of that, it may still make it very hard to take good care of them. And I think it's hard sometimes. I think if you can diplomatically suggest, I just don't think we're doing very well, and I wonder if you'd be willing to see one of my colleagues, sometimes that'll work. It depends on how the patient is feeling about the situation. And then the sort of last resort is the sort of legal process of literally firing a patient. And that would normally be if somebody misses appointments, if they're You know, if they're really ignoring your advice, if they're putting themselves in danger with the medicines that you're prescribing. And then that's a process where I believe every state has their own system of, you know, how do you inform the patient? You have to provide them with alternatives for their care, and your kind of risk management people will know, like, what you're supposed to do.
And then in your experience, how often does it boil down to a clash in belief system sometimes, and sometimes, you know, what's perceived as an ethical question?
I think it's unusual, because there are usually ways, I think, to navigate those differences in ways that people will understand. And there are exceptions, and I've had my share of exceptions, but I think it doesn't happen terribly often. Mm-hmm. I think one thing that really will help most physicians is to simply develop a sense of what kind of patients annoy them. And the reason I say that is because if you can know, for me, for example, it's very simple. It's patients who are very entitled. So if I walk in the room and the dad is sitting in my chair and he's on his BlackBerry and he calls me Neil, as soon as I walk in the room, I know that there's a danger that I'll get annoyed. And there's a bigger danger, I'll say something I wish I hadn't said. And one never goes home at the end of the day and says to your spouse, I'm really glad I yelled at that patient. It's just not the way it works. So in order to avoid that, I think once you have that bit of self-awareness, these are the kind of patients that really annoy me, you can just take a deep breath and make a conscious decision not to get annoyed. And it's in our control. And so then that saves you a lot of these kind of argumentative, difficult situations that might end up kind of really hurting the relationship.
Going back to the time constraints, which is a usual thing that comes up with most physicians when I'm sure you talk about, you know, communication and taking the time. What are some techniques that you incorporate patient and, you know, empathic communication into a busy practice?
Yeah, I have one that I think really works, because what I've learned over the years is that a lot of doctors were trained, if they went to a U.S. medical school, in this notion of that you start the interview with an open-ended question, you know, just tell me how you are. And doctors develop a concern that by doing this they're going to open a can of worms or a Pandora's box, and the conversation will go on forever. And I've been told at the VA that can happen quite often with people with their difficult war experiences that they want to relay. And so I train residents and medical students with a very simple sentence, which sounds like, would it be okay if I interrupt you to ask some specific questions? And simply by doing that, interrupting, by naming it, by asking permission to do it, you can then move on to your own sort of patient's doctor-centered part of the interview. And that's a really wonderful way to save a huge amount of time that could be spent in kind of a rambling answer that's not giving you the information that might possibly help the patient.
Okay. All right. Let me go back to your project in Gondar and ask you, what's going to be the next step? When do you plan to visit again, or what are the next steps?
I'm hoping to be back in September for a few weeks, and I'm hoping in that period of time that we will have obtained the results of our patient survey and can use the time to actually fashion some simple guidelines for a medical interview, and then create some videos. I think if we have the videos in hand, then we can start to really convince all the stakeholders that this is something that's going to really make a big difference in the medical medical education. And it's our long-term hope that this would become of interest to other medical schools in Ethiopia, and eventually that this method of building a course. And I must emphasize, I think I realized on this last trip that an important part of the method is the collaboration between social scientists and doctors. I think that physicians alone are sometimes battle with what it would take to bring in the patient's perspective. And I think there are sociologists and anthropologists who see the world in a slightly different way and might be able to help us a lot. The difficulty, and Tana, I think the difficulty is that we're not used to working together. And so I think we start out with, in any medical center or university, we start out with a certain amount of distrust, for want of a better word. And then it takes time to kind of develop the connections. But I think if we do it successfully, it creates a model for how you can actually use the linguistics and the medical anthropology and the medical sociology to really help doctors look at the situation in a different, from a different perspective.
And one thing we do in hospice and palliative medicine is this interdisciplinary team, you know, that consists of not just the physician, but, you know, the nurse, the social worker, the recreational therapist, the chaplain, and all those that contribute to that. So that also brings the awareness of providers, especially in Ethiopia, for example, that how much their patients and their families kind of rely on spiritual and religious beliefs, and in visiting, you know, traditional practice too. So that the patients, like you said about that, it was very interesting about the fontanelle concept and what was the soft spot. So that gives permission for the patients to share their experiences in the alternative medicine arena.
Yeah, I've developed some early sense of just how powerful those ideas are in Ethiopia. I know that those are beliefs that are very strongly held by very many people, and doctors understanding what they are is absolutely critical.
Yeah, there's a kind of informal study done with traditional medicine use among Ethiopians, and some studies quote as high as 80%. And what was more interesting is that, you know, the assumption was it was used because there was no other available alternative, but this showed that even in diaspora population, some form of you know, either plant-based medicine or some you know, spiritual-based interventions are widely used, so that incorporating that into the communication may be important.
Yeah, but, you know, I think it's something we all do. If you go into our medicine cabinet, it's full of echinacea, and I think this is a worldwide phenomenon, that we're doing this sort of, we're kind of always integrating various health systems into our approach to our health, and so... And it's certainly the 80%. I'm not surprised. That's sort of what I would have imagined for Ethiopia.
Okay. And then any similarities and differences between, say, like Ethiopia, Kenya? You told us South Africa was a little bit different in the way they covered it.
I think the only thing I've noticed is that sort of way in which patients are very deferential, more than they would be in the United States. And I think that's sort of I don't know why that transcends those very different countries, but it seems to be, you might have an idea, it seems to be the case that that's something that's built in. Maybe the power relationship is so much more powerful that people tend to not imagine challenging their doctor or being involved in medical decision-making. And then, of course, the challenge of being in a very busy clinic or hospital.
I would imagine, you know, in a place like the United States, that has also evolved through the years, like maybe, I don't know, several decades ago, that kind of differential treatment, that kind of the doctor knows it all, it probably was as prevalent at that time, I would think.
Absolutely. I think, in fact, in my medical lifetime, I think it was, to a large extent, the HIV epidemic that created a precedent for patients becoming informed about their own health. And once that started, it just spread like wildfire.
Okay. So that, on the whole, I guess, is a good thing, though.
Oh, definitely. Okay. Definitely.
All right. Okay. So do you have a focus, like, what are the medical students or staff physicians?
Well, our first focus is going to be medical students, and during the several-week period when they're transitioning from their academic years to their clinical years, there's sort of a period when they have sort of a transition, and we're going to try to integrate that course there. But to be honest, I think that the necessity for nurses and midwives is just as powerful, if not more so. And we'd love to, we've been talking about trying to bring this into some of the trainings that are done when when health providers come to Gonder for their kind of continuing medical education.
Mm-hmm.
So we think there's so many different ways that something could be integrated, and we think even just if we could just put together a series of really good teaching videos and use that as that and some role playing as a teaching method, those same things could be used in a wide variety of settings.
Okay. So for the medical professionals in the audience, are there like two or three just takeaway messages that you would like to give as far as, you know, improving their communication skills?
I think that it's yes, I have one of them. To me, is that I think that the our strongest opportunity to learn about all of this is when we find ourselves, unfortunately, being patients or family members of patients. And I really would urge doctors to pay attention when that's happening, because you'll instantly see practices that you really like and things you don't like. And if you can imagine using that as a learning experience, and then bringing that back to your own work, I find that that's extremely beneficial. So that would be one thing I'd mention. And then I would just go back to that analogy where we started, that what it would take to be on the same side of the table with the patient, looking at the thing together. And to imagine, it sounds so obvious, but to imagine or to remember that, and it sounds sort of cliche, that patients are people like us. They're not another tribe or another race. They're just people who happen to be sick, and we're going to be patients as well. And if you can keep that in mind, which is very difficult to keep in mind, I think it can only help you to do a better job.
And then a similar word of advice for our non-medical provider audience, how they empower themselves more and how they...
As patients.
As patients, right.
Yeah, I think it's just, now that if you've heard what we've been talking about for the last 45 minutes, to imagine yourself... entitled to that, and helping the doctor to making an extra effort to help the doctor to understand how you're feeling, and in some cases being very direct, which would be saying, I'm not sure you heard what I said. Would it be okay if I explain it again more carefully? Ways that are polite, but ways that kind of make it clear that it's important to you the doctor hears your story.
Great. So this brings us to the conclusion of our program for this evening. I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Neil Prose, who's a professor of pediatrics and dermatology at Duke University in Durham, in North Carolina, and an affiliate faculty member at the Duke Global Health Institute. He's currently involved in developing a curriculum in doctor-patient communication at the University of Gondar Medical School in Ethiopia. Thank you for joining us this evening, Neil, and hope to hear more about your work at Gondar University.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
All right, and I want to thank you, the audience, for tuning in to the Global Health Forum. We invite you to join us every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. As always, you can help shape our program by submitting your comments and suggestions through info@peoplepeople.org or People to People's Facebook page. Remember, if you're unable to tune in live, you can access the archive show using the link on People to People website. An announcement for an upcoming event. People to People will be co-hosting a summit on Pan-African higher education in Addis Ababa. This will be held at the African Union on July 17th and 18th. We encourage those of you who have the opportunity to attend and encourage others to attend too. The conference will be a topic on one of our radio shows in the coming weeks. I'm your host, Dr. Antana Hapte, and I'll be back with you the first Thursday of next month with another segment of the Global Health Forum. Thank you for your support and stay engaged.